Verse 11 of chapter 6 says that an angel of the Lord came and sat under the oak tree that was at Ophrah, which belonged to Joash, the Abzarite, as his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the winepress to order to save it from the Midianites. Now, having said that, let's look at a few more of the lessons that we learned. Learn from this. Those are the first three that we looked at: intercession, the Word of God, and worship. And there's another thing that really comes to mind in this story, is that there's a broader perspective here that Gideon has lost sight of. And that tends to happen to us as well. You see, the situation that Gideon was in didn't just affect him, but everyone around him. All of the people of Israel were being oppressed and afflicted, and we're having to find some way to feed their family. All the misery that's been visited upon him, his companions, his friends, his neighbors, his fellow citizens were experiencing the same thing. Because the entire nation was being harassed and oppressed and threatened by the Midianites. Now here's an important thing that you need to understand about Old Testament narratives. And the word narrative just means story. And two-thirds of the Bible is stories, and it's an effective way to teach. So that's why we tell them today. But you need to understand, when you read, especially the Old Testament, the story of Israel, when you read the Old Testament narratives, almost always, now listen carefully, there are three levels to every narrative. There are one story, but three different levels. First of all, there is the personal level that deals with the individual who is at the heart of the story. But secondly, there is a national level. How does this person's story impact or relate to God's higher purpose of what he's doing in the nation of Israel? And thirdly, the third level is at a universal level. How does this story of this person impact the life of Israel as a nation? And how does that, what are the implications of that as it may affect the other nations around the world? And what God is doing not only with Israel, but with the other nations of the world through the Gentiles. Take, for example, the story of Joseph being sold into slavery, going to prison, going to Egypt. That's the personal story of Joseph. That's his story. But that story doesn't take place in isolation to what's going on around him and God's broader plan. Then it isn't just about Joseph. Joseph is one piece in a bigger picture that is a part, in a puzzle that is a part of a bigger picture than he can possibly imagine. You see, the first level is personal, what's happened to Joseph. But the second level is, how does what's happening to Joseph impact the nation of Israel? And I think you can see this. Joseph's story, by coming to the throne, actually puts him into place to preserve the nation of Israel from starvation, to keep this family of Jacob alive and to preserve the nation of Israel. So Joseph's story, it isn't just about Joseph. It isn't about just him getting out of prison. It's also about what happens when he gets out of prison and how his story is going to impact somebody else's story. And in this case, the nation of Israel. And how does that relate to the third level, to the universal? I think you can understand that if Jacob and his family starve to death and die, there's no Messiah. Because the promise of God to Israel and through Abraham was that through his seed, through his line, through the nation of Israel, all the nations of the world would be blessed. And that is fulfilled because Messiah comes through the lineage of Abraham and his family. And if that's why the Jews have been persecuted, why Haman was trying to kill. The devil has waged war against the Jewish nation and still is to this day. So you see that. Well, understanding that as you go to the story of Gideon, you have to recognize that this isn't just about Gideon. There are three levels at work here. His personal story has a direct impact not only on him and his family, but also upon the story of Israel, of what God is doing in Israel at this particular time. And that story certainly has an impact at a universal level, because their deliverance from Midian relates to the universal implications by perpetuating the Jewish nation from which Messiah would come. Now, I'm pretty sure that Gideon probably did not see all of that, because at that moment in the wine press, all he could see was his personal misery. Is this connecting with you? That's all he can see. When you get in the wine press, that's all you can see. He isn't really, at least initially, he isn't really thinking about anything or anybody but himself. And then along the way, he is awakened to the fact that Israel needs deliverance. I'm not sure that he ever caught the universal implications of how it may relate to you and I. But one of the things that had to happen to him was that he had to broaden his perspective. And I guess what I'm trying to say, when I say broaden your perspective, it's just another way of saying you got to get outside of you. You have to look beyond yourself. Listen, you're not the only duck in the puddle. You're not the only pig in the pen. It's not just about you. And I can tell you, our personal stories never are told in isolation to the relationships and connections that we have with other people. This isn't only true of Old Testament narratives, it's true of us. Our personal story in some way impacts somebody else's story. But you can lose sight of that in the wine press, because the wine press has a way of putting blinders on us. In the wine press, we get tunnel vision. You're just locked into the fact you become so self-absorbed that all you can see is your misery, your problems, your pain, so that the vastness of the universe is reduced to the narrow dimensions of your wine press and the misery that's going on there. And our focus becomes entirely upon us, to the fact that that's all we think. We just look here. Every day we get up and we live in the wine press and we're focused on the wine press and we rehearse our complaints and we mull over our impossibilities, unable to see beyond ourselves. Our problems and pain are magnified over and over and over again, and we become so ingrown that we lose sight of a bigger picture, of a greater need and a greater opportunity. And if you just sit in the wine press all day and feel sorry for yourself, you can become so fixed and fixated on you and your problems and your pain. It just simply consumes you. And you have to recognize that there is a bigger story here. And that in some way your story connects and has implications beyond you and beyond yourself and beyond what you're doing. And don't you see, that's why God is willing to put Joseph through 13 years in the dungeon, even though Joseph is having to suffer during that time. Because God is grooming, he's grooming a boy to become a man. He's grooming this kid to become a prince. He's grooming him and preparing him for the throne because he sees what is coming. Because he knows that Joseph's story, it isn't just about Joseph, that there's somebody else who's going to be impacted there. And I have to tell you that getting beyond yourself and outside of yourself is one of the greatest therapies that you can possibly do. Renowned psychologist Carl Menninger was asked one time, what would you advise someone who is on the verge of a nervous breakdown? He said, lock the door to your house, put the key in your pocket, go find somebody else who is in need, pour yourself into helping them, and you will get well. But you see, when you don't do that, your mind is constantly on you. And suddenly when you get beyond yourself and your mind, you get focused on something other than you. You get focused on somebody else and you have the opportunity to minister and care for someone else. And it has a way of bringing healing to you. So you have to get beyond the narrow confines. Believe me, life is bigger than your problem. God's intention, His plan for you is bigger than your current situation. And where you are now is not necessarily an indication of where God is taking you. You're not buried there, you're planted there. And maybe only for a season. But don't lose sight of the bigger perspective. And then the third thing, second thing today, was a positive influence. Now I could have put encouragement there, it would have been the same thing. But what's key is in this story, one thing that's obvious is you need to have the right people around you. You need a support group. Now, you may think that you don't, but we do. You know why the redwoods are able to grow so tall? I mean, they're magnificent trees, hundreds of feet into the air. When you stand at the base and look at them and you remember that these branches were waving in the breeze when Jesus walked the earth. That's how old they are. And yet they have a real shallow root system. Usually the roots will go down into the ground as deep as the tree stands above the ground, but not with redwoods. They're very shallow. And that's why a lot of them in the state parks have, the national parks have fences where they don't want people to get too close to the trees because the root systems are very shallow. And yet they survive hundreds and thousands of years through all types of storms and fires. And you know why? Because they grow in groves. And the roots go down and spread out, and then they intertwine with the roots from other trees. So figuratively speaking, the redwoods are kind of leaning on each other. And that's why they grow tall. And believe me, everybody at some point will in their life will come to the place where you're going to need somebody else. You're going to need support. And that's really who is supporting you and who is around you. Now, in this story, it's pretty obvious. 32,000 men answered the call and came out to fight with Gideon. He sent 22,000 of them home. And at the Lord's direction, he said to them, chapter 7, verse 3, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave. In essence, you know, I don't think I can count on you. I can't count on you in a fight. And I don't want you to demoralize the troops and poison the rest of my soldiers with your cowardice. And so 22,000 left. And then God said, you still have too many. You still don't have the right people. And so he did that little test of drinking water, and 9,700 of them went home, and he was left only with 300 people. But it was important in this story for Gideon to be surrounded by the right people and to have the right people on board with him. He needed to be surrounded by stout-hearted men like Joshua and Caleb who had a different spirit in them. And could not be persuaded by the negative witness of 10 other spies. And believe me, as it was in the case of the spies, in the case of Gideon, trust me when I tell you that the negative voices will almost always outnumber the positive voices. I don't even know that's true. You won't have any trouble finding negative people. The question is, whose report will you believe? Who are you going to listen to? You need to have the right people around you. People who will build you up. People who will encourage you. People who will pray for you. People who will affirm you. And sometimes people who will kind of jack you up. You know what I'm talking about? When you get to poor mouthing and feeling sorry for yourself and, you know, somebody, and, you know, in Christian love, bam, you know, get with it. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? Come on now, get with it. And sometimes you need that. Somebody to kind of jack you up. A little bit. And that's what he's doing. It's important that you have the right people around you. On the flip side of that, you have to deal with you have to close the door to the negative influences and the negative voices that will keep you talking to yourself in the wine press. You have to silence the negative people in your life. Now, sometimes that's hard because you may live with negative people. As much as possible. And listen, I know it's touchy because you don't want to disconnect or disrespect people and be rude. That's not what I'm saying. In wise ways, there may be some people just constantly poisoning your mind and your attitudes. And you know what I'm talking about? I don't know how many of you would remember this, but when I was a kid, there used to be a cartoon called Lippy the Lion and Hardy Har Har. Anybody ever see Lippy the Lion and Hardy Har Har? Just me and Ray. Connoisseurs of good television, right? Lippy was a lion and Hardy Har Har was a laughing hyena. And the irony of it was that Hardy Har Har never laughed. He was always whining. Everywhere they went, it was, oh no, oh me, oh my, what kind of mess have you gotten us into now? We'll never get... He never said anything, he never laughed. He was always whining, always saw the worst. Maybe you remember the little Abner cartoon. The guy, the cloud followed him around. Wasn't that the little Abner, his cloud? Some people are like that cloud. They're like Hardy Har Har. They never see the bright. They never see anything good. They can never find anything positive. They are just negative, critical people. There are two things about that. Number one is at some point you cannot let those people have their way in your life. You may have to distance yourself from some of those people. And the second thing is, don't you become the kind of person that other people need to distance themselves from. Why not become an encourager? Why not have a positive word? No, how about having a good word? And sometimes I know it may be people that you work by every day, so you can't physically remove yourself from them. But you have to somehow build some sort of a filter or a barrier so that that stuff doesn't seep into your mind, into your heart, and so that you're not buying into that, so that their spirit of negativism doesn't become so contagious that they're continually poisoning you. Because in the wine press, you need the right people around you. The third thing that is not quite so conspicuous in this story is courage. And I say you have to look hard to find it, because the whole reason Gideon's in the wine press is because he's afraid. He's intimidated and afraid. And on the eve of the battle with Midian, he is very fearful, and God sends him down to the camp so he can overhear the soldiers talking to encourage him. And we'll talk about that next Sunday. But he was very afraid on the eve of battle, and he needed encouragement, and God gave him the encouragement he needed. But here's what you need to understand about courage. The presence of fear doesn't mean the absence of courage. In fact, I would argue that it is only in the context of fear that courage is defined and has meaning. Because if you're not afraid, you don't really need courage. Courage doesn't mean that you're not afraid. Courage is the strength to take action while you're afraid. John Wayne said, courage is being afraid but saddling up anyway. Eddie Rickenbacker said that courage is fear that has said its prayers. And Gideon was afraid. And God had to help him get beyond his fear, and he did so. And I want you to see that in the next message. But in spite of his fear, in spite of his intimidation, in spite of 7 years of case history now, of being oppressed and beaten down and defeated, in spite of that, Gideon comes out of the wine press and dares to take risk. He takes decisive action in the face of the enemy, even though he knew it could cost him his life. He took strong action in the face of the enemy. And when I wrote that, it reminded me of David when he went out to face Goliath. And after Goliath has cursed him by his gods and ridiculed him, and David makes that incredible speech, "You come against me with a sword and a spear, but I come against you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the army of Israel, whom you have defied. And this day I will feed your flesh to the birds." And the Bible said that Goliath was so outraged that he roared. Now, I can only imagine the roar of a 10-foot giant. He roared. And the scripture says that David ran to the roar. He ran. He ran to him. He ran to the roar. And sometimes you have to run to the roar. You have to have courage. You have to, especially is that hard to do when you've had repeated failure and setback and disappointment after disappointment after disappointment. And the wine press has a way that it can take your will and it can take your courage and it can make you afraid to try again. But to get out of the wine press, you have to be willing to risk it again, to try again. Do you know the largest vein of gold ever discovered in the United States was found only a few feet away from where a previous mining expedition had stopped digging? Somebody said the test of character is this: what will it take to make you quit? That's the true test of character. Courage isn't the absence of fear. It is only when you're afraid that courage is demonstrated. Courage is when you function. You don't capitulate to fear, but you function in spite of your fear, and you dare to try again and risk it again. And without that, you never get out of the wine press. And the fourth thing and the last thing I want to show you this morning, I want to show you warfare. And make no mistake about it, getting out of the wine press will require spiritual warfare. In your Bible, look down in chapter 6, at verse 25, the angel has disappeared. Gideon has built an altar of worship. sacrifice and called the place Jehovah Shalom. Jehovah is my peace. That's up in verse 24. Look at verse 25. I believe God really wants to speak to us out of this verse right here. Now, on the same night, the Lord said to him, take your father's bull and a second bull, 7 years old. Now, why would God specify a sacrifice that was 7 years old? Can't prove it, but I think it may be because that's how long they'd been oppressed. Chapter 6, verse 1 said they'd been oppressed by Midian for 7 years. And I think there's something of symbolism there. Seven's a number of completion and all that stuff. Don't really know, but just a thought. That's not what's important. What is important is what he says next. Take your father's bull and the second bull, 7 years old. Notice this next part. And pull down the altar of Baal, which belongs to your father. And cut down the Asherah that is beside it. And the New American Standard says in verse 26, and build an altar to the Lord. All capital letters, build an altar to Jehovah, your God, on the top of this stronghold. Build an altar to God, to the Lord, to Jehovah, on top of this stronghold. Now, I want to show you three things in this. There are three things here that are crucial. Absolutely crucial. And if you can get a hold of it, and it can get a hold of you and me, it can change our lives today. The first thing, notice what he says in warfare. He says, first of all, he says, pull down the altar of Baal, which belongs to your father. Pull down the altar of Baal. Pull down your father's idols. This is no doubt a reference to the family God. But it clearly points to Gideon's past. Gideon, this is what you've grown up with. This is your history. And to get beyond yourself and get out of the wine press, you have got to deal with the gods of your past. You've got to deal with your history. You're going to have to deal with your father's idols. The things that your father erected in your life. Tear down your family idols. Let me tell you, it is not an exaggeration when I say to you that many, many people, in fact, I could probably say most people, carry the wounds of a dysfunctional family into their adult life. There are things that your father planted in you that some of you are still dealing with to this very day. And maybe not just your father, don't want to pick on the dad, but maybe your mother. Things that out of your family of origin, the home you grew up in, there are deep wounds and deep scars there that to this day are still exerting an influence in your life. How you think, how you relate to other people, how you connect or how you disconnect, how you relate to God, your attitudes that come out of your past. People are still bound in the chains of the past, still carrying the scars, perhaps of emotional abuse or physical abuse, still affected by the negatives from your family of origin, the father who abused you, the father who abandoned you, the father who neglected you, or the mother who did the same. You're still angry at your mother and your father, and some of them, they have been dead for many years, but from the grave, they are still ruling and controlling your life to this very day. An alcoholic father, a drug-addicted mother, parents who shamed you. I talked about toxic shame and the wounds of shame and the messages out of childhood that were given to us, sometimes unintentionally, by our families of origin, the siblings who ridiculed you and have created a lifelong inferiority complex because of it. And for others, the failures and disappointments and hurts of the past stand in your life like erect idols. Idols to the past, to your history, to who you still bow down to. And Paul said in Philippians 3:13, forgetting what lies behind, reaching forward to what lies ahead, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. And believe me, I understand and know that what I'm telling you is absolutely the truth. To get out of the winepress, you have to pull down the altars of your past and never, ever let your memories become greater than your promises. I'm sorry it happened. I'm not insensitive to the pain that it causes. I know the pain that it causes. I'm sorry that it happened. But why will you let it linger? Hasn't it controlled you for long enough and embittered you and created a cloud between you and other people and you between you and God? How long will this altar be allowed to stand? Your father's idols continue to stand in your life and control you and rule you to this day and keep you forever in the winepress. The second thing that he says, cut down the Asherah that is beside it. Now, Asherah was an Assyrian goddess, the wife of the Assyrian god of war in their pantheon of deities. And Baal and Asherah basically are the two Canaanite deities that Israel had come to worship. And of course, that is the whole reason they're in the winepress to begin with. And if you look at it and understand the symbolism and what it represents, Baal and Asherah, it's really what leads us to the winepress. A lot of the depression, a lot of the stuff that we are sometimes delayed emotions that come out of dysfunctional childhoods and family of origin issues and things that you've never resolved in your past. People who are deeply wounded by shame are more susceptible to criticism, least likely to try again because failure is so painful. And failure somehow denies their worth as a human being. And all of it feeds into it. And believe, if I were to go into that too deep, it would be six more sermons, so I can't do that. These are the two principal deities, Baal and Asherah. And Asherah was like a carved pillar, or a carved pillar, I should say. Sometimes they just carved them out of trees. It was the trunk of a tree. I don't think that the image of a totem pole would be too far, though it probably wasn't as high and it may not have been painted and decorated, but it was similar to that. It was. In fact, the Bible sometimes refers to the Asherah pole. So more than just, you know, like a carved image like you would expect, it was like a pole, a monument that was erected to this god. And what you need to understand about Asherah was the goddess of fertility. And the worship of this goddess among the Assyrians, the worship was very obscene and licentious and erotic. It involved sexual perversion of all kinds. And there's a lot that I could say about this, but I think it would be inappropriate and too explicit for a mixed Sunday morning congregation. But believe me, Asherah represented the worst in perversion. And he says to him, not only do you need to deal with the idols from your father, you're going to have to deal with Asherah. You're going to have to deal with her influence. The warfare that frees you from the winepress will almost always require you and I to deal with our lusts. Now, when I say the word lust, mostly people think sex. And certainly lust has a sexual, sensual, erotic connotation. But when the Bible talks about the lust of the flesh, it includes sensuality, but it isn't limited to that. It is rather talking about the desires and the ambitions, the passions of the flesh. And it isn't just limited to sexual lust, though that is a serious problem for many people. and one that many people struggle with all of their lives. But it includes so many other things. The lust of the flesh. It can include jealousy and envy. It can include any of these poisonous emotions that we saw on the screen just a moment ago. Lust of the flesh. Pride and arrogance. Bitterness and an unforgiving spirit. Grudges. Holding of grudges. It's not just sexual lust. But rather, listen, anything that is defiling your life. Any corrupt influence in your life is represented by the Asherah pole. Yes, inordinate sensuality would certainly be included. And we live in a pornographic society. But it also would include unbridled ambitions, unrestrained greed, all that is of pride and human arrogance, an out-of-control thought life, an out-of-control tongue. For some people, it would be some critical, condemning, judgmental spirit that rises out of the flesh, that poisons their life. Anger and a temper with a hair trigger. Bitterness. Hatred. Racism. Still deeply seated and deeply ingrained in so many people. But it is a controlling, corrupting influence that arises and is born not out of the spirit, but arises out of the flesh. That disrespects people who are created and made in the image of God, for whom Jesus died. Asherah represents any defiling influence, attitude, behavior, every corrupting influence, every corrosive influence. God says, cut it down. If you want out of the wine press, if you want Midian off of your back, deal with the idols from your family. Deal with the idols of your father. Deal with the idols out of your past, with your history. And deal with the corrupting, defiling influences that are keeping you bound in the winepress. And then he says, build an altar to Jehovah on top of this stronghold. Now here's what strikes me about this, and don't you miss this. This is what is important. He didn't say to them, build an altar to Jehovah and put it next to your Asherah pole. He didn't say build an altar to God and put it over here in between your altar to Baal and the Asherah pole. He said tear down the altar of Baal and cut down the Asherah pole and then build an altar to Jehovah on top of the stronghold. And you see, that's really important to understand. 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, this wouldn't even need to be said. But it needs to be said today because there are a lot of people, many of them in church every Sunday, who seem to think that they can just add Jesus to all the other gods they serve. And so they have their own little pantheon of deities. That somehow a confession of faith in Christ can be superimposed over any lifestyle. No matter how ungodly or unbiblical it may be. And these folks, these kind of folks, would reason with the prodigal son and say, you know what, you don't have to leave the hog pen. Let's just paint the old one. Or we'll build a bigger and better hog pen. And if you really insist on going back to the Father's house, just here, take a bucket of slop with you when you go. You cannot build an altar to Jehovah next to the altar of Baal and the Asherah pole. If you think you can, you are deceived. And all the praying and all the warfare that you do, as long as those two altars are standing. Don't you understand? Don't you realize? Don't you recognize and know? And recognize the fact that you can never break the hold of the stronghold if you leave the altar to Baal standing and the Asherah pole still standing in your life. Don't you understand that the stronghold derives its power over you from those very idols? The things from your past that control you and the corrupting influences that defile you is what's keeping you in the winepress. And you'll never get out until you deal with Baal and Asherah. So he says, tear down the altar to Baal, cut down the Asherah pole, and build an altar. And I love the way the New American Standard translates this, renders it. Build an altar to Jehovah on top of your stronghold. And you understand, we talk about strongholds, 2 Corinthians 10. The strongholds are in the mind. They're mental strongholds. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. Vain imaginations, irrational beliefs, vain imaginations that exalt themselves against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. The strongholds are in your mind. Don't you know that's where bitterness and hatred resides? Don't you know that's where racism resides? Don't you know where unbelief resides? As a man thinks, so is he. Guard your mind with all diligence, for out of it flow the issues of life. Put an altar over the stronghold. What does an altar represent? The first three things on our list. It represents intercession. It represents worship. It represents prayer. Build an altar on top of your anger and fear. Let worship and intercession and prayer break the stronghold of anger and fear. Let it break the stronghold of depression and intimidation on top of your skepticism and cynicism, your fatigue and your hopelessness, on top of your indignation and your loneliness. Build an altar. Build an altar to God over the stronghold. Build an altar over the pain of your past. Build an altar over your lust and your pride. Build an altar over the emotional wounds and family scars. Erect the altar of Jehovah over your stronghold. He's not talking about a quick 3-minute prayer at the end of Sunday morning worship service at the altar. He's talking about letting prayer and worship and intercession, those godly positive things, let those become the dominating influences over the top of you. And watch the anger. Watch the power of anger and depression and fear and worry and hatred and all of these corrupting, defiling influences. Watch them be broken in your life. The tendency is to run and get an appointment with a counselor. And I'm not against counselors. There's times when you need, I said we need support. It's not a contradiction. There are times when we need help and we need to talk to somebody else. And that can be very valuable. I'm not saying that isn't important. Or that we run to the bookstore and buy a new book. And there's some good books out there. And I read a lot of them. Or we pick up the phone. Or we resort to a lot of other things. And some of those things are good and in themselves. But I'm just persuaded. Listen. That there'd probably be a lot less need for counselors and running to this revival or that conference and looking for an answer. And if people would just simply erect an altar to God over the strongholds. And in spiritual war, and that's what it is. What are the weapons? They're not carnal. They're mighty through God to the pulling down of stronghold. Intercession, prayer. The effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much, the Bible says. Prayer and worship and intercession. Instead of being angry, worship. Instead of being fearful and afraid, worship. Erect an altar to Jehovah on top of the thing that is binding you and holding you. And you know what? If you do that, you probably won't even need to come see me. You probably won't even need a counselor. It will do for you what a new book won't do. Now here's what I know. God has given us something this morning. something very powerful that has the power to absolutely transform lives here today. The question is, what will we do with it? We'll look to the Bible for answers. God has given us some answers. But unfortunately, a lot of us, this is not the answer we wanted. What we really want is for an easy answer that doesn't require very much of us. God, just fix my problem. Get me out of the wine press, but let me keep bail. I've been wallowing in this misery all of my life, but I'm not ready to give up that pain from my past. God, I really want to get out of the wine press, but I kind of like Asherah. Well, Asherah makes me feel good. Don't want to give her up. You understand what I'm saying? We want simple. We want God just to wave a wand and fix everything without it costing us anything or requiring anything of us. And I'm going to tell you right now, nobody has ever gotten out of the wine press with that frame of mind or attitude. God says to everything that happens in this story from this point on, the defeat of the Midianites, this great miracle that occurs with 300 army takes on a whole nation and defeats them, the divine intervention, the spiritual dream that's given to Gideon, all of the things that take place, none of them would have taken place if Gideon had disobeyed God at this point. If he had left the altar to Baal standing, if he had left the Asherah untouched, he probably would have died in the wine press. And Israel would have been oppressed for many years before God would raise up someone other than Gideon perhaps to deliver them. Because that's his M.O. Everything that happens after this, the release of miracles and God's intervention, flows out of his obedience to this command. Tear down the altar of Baal that your father has planted in your life. The idols of your past, your history. Deal with these corrupting, defiling influences that are corrupting your life. Erect an altar to Jehovah over the top of this stronghold. And when he does, it sets in motion, a chain of events that will break the back of Midian and restore fruitful harvest to the people of Israel once more.